Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your support of our locally owned business. We very much appreciate your business. Lev Grossman is a senior writer and the book critic for Time magazine and the author of the best-selling and critically acclaimed novel, Codex. His new novel, The Magicians, is a thrilling, fantastic, and original, which I loved, coming-of-age story about a young man practicing magic in the real world. I guess it was inevitable that the novel would be compared to the Harry Potter books. They are certainly similar in some themes, but as George R.R. Martin so eloquently put it, The Magicians is to Harry Potter as a shot of Irish whiskey is to a glass of weak tea. Please join me in welcoming Lev Grossman.
Thank you guys so much for coming. I feel like I should start by saying something about the Tattered Cover. I've never been here before, and it's astounding. We don't have bookstores like this in New York City, where I live. They don't exist. It's not like every city has one. You know, I think probably sometime in the midst of time we used to have them, but we neglected them and we didn't shop there. And now all we have is Barnes and Nobles is, and we're sorry. We wish we had our independent bookstores back, but we didn't support them and they died. So let us stand as a cautionary tale. It's early enough in this book's life cycle. This book was published last Tuesday, and it's early enough in the life cycle that I don't actually have a super suave talk worked out around it. So if I start just digressing crazily, make a slashing throat sort of gesture or something, because that might happen. I'm going to talk for a little bit about how the book came to be, and then I'm going to read a little bit from it. Then maybe we'll have questions, if there are any questions, which there might not be. I'm a fantasy person, a fantasy reader. I pretty much always have been. My parents are both English professors. They both have PhDs in English, and then they went on to teach for years and years at various universities, and they're retired now. But they had a very weird attitude toward my upbringing as a reader, which is that they sort of, it was like the parents of the Williams sisters kind of drilled them obsessively from the point from when they were like -5 weeks old to become tennis prodigies. That's kind of the attitude toward parenting that my parents took. I think they had some idea that we'd be sort of crazy, I don't know what, literary prodigies. I don't know. I don't even think that exists. So we were sort of really sort of aggressively put through the classics of the Western canon when, you know, we were like 7. And it was, you know, whatever. We read a lot. Like, that was fine. It worked. We became readers. There was a point, I think, when I was probably about 8, where my dad made a just massive tactical error and read me The Hobbit, at which point my whole reading life, it's not that it diverged. Well, it diverged. It split. It split into two halves. There was the half that was sort of legit and accredited, where I read sort of literary works of fiction. And then there was the much larger semi-secret half, where I read fantasy. And I did that all the time, not only because I loved it, but because it irritated my parents. Which is also why I played video games and read comic books obsessively. But especially the fantasy, I think, was galling to them. I hope so. And oddly enough, that this kind of bifurcated reading life persisted for years and years. Certainly when I went to college, where I majored in literature. I eventually became a grad student and spent 3 years as a grad student studying comparative literature. And I always read fantasy and science fiction. And I also read, you know, the classics. I worked on mostly on the modernists, meaning Joyce and Wolfe and Hemingway and Fitzgerald and people like that. But all that fantasy stuff was sort of building up. There was a particular moment when it was in 1996, when I was in my third year of graduate school, and I was studying for my orals, which is this huge exam that you take, and they put a lot of emphasis on it, and you have to study for a year, and it takes 3 hours, and if you flunk it, you're supposed to feel really bad, and then you have to spend another year studying for it. So it's a total disaster, and lots of people flunk it. It's, you know, it's actually not sort of a... It's not a fake exam, it's a real exam, and they will flunk you, which is horrible. So about a week before I was supposed to take my my orals, I think I was reading Finnegan's Wake, a book which I had many, many times claimed to have read, but not actually read, and I still haven't read, but I was really trying hard to read it. And it was weird, some sort of dike gave way in my brain, and I sort of robotically jumped up from Finnegan's Wake and ran over to my Mac Classic, which is what we had in 1996, and I began writing some scenes from a novel, from a fantasy novel. And the novel was going to be about the education of a young wizard, which, in 1996, let me tell you, was a very fresh and original idea. That seemed innovative as all hell, because there wasn't any Harry Potter yet. About 6 hours later, I looked horror-stricken at what I'd written, and I sort of confined it to some dark corner of my hard drive. At the time, I was writing something that I thought was based on Ursula Le Guin. So I don't know if any of you have read A Wizard of Earthsea, but it's a fantastic novel, better than this novel, which you should go read that first if you haven't read it. And it has a scene that takes place on an island called Roke, and there's a school for magic there, and it's totally awesome. Everybody hangs out, and they're sort of learning to do spells, and they're sitting around with their chums casting little enchantments to turn chicken bones into little flying birds. It's incredibly fun, and it goes on for a chapter and a half, and then it's over. And you always feel sad because you wanted to spend more time on the island of Roke. I had the idea that I would write a whole novel that was set at a school for wizards, and wouldn't that be great? Well, this was obviously a billion-dollar idea, which I then failed to execute, and I left on my hard drive for the next 8 years, until 2004, when a few different things happened. What happened in 2004? I had a midlife crisis, which is a great time to start a novel. I read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is a novel by Susanna Clarke, also better than my novel, and just utterly fantastic. And what I saw when I read that book was that it combined those two sort of otherwise mutually exclusive halves of my brain, the sort of high fantasy literature part and the fantasy part. And in fact, it turned out that they weren't mutually exclusive at all. And in fact, you could have it all. You could write a novel that was literary like that and fantastical like that and combine the best of both worlds. And that's what Susanna Clarke had done. And I would be damned if I wasn't going to do that as well. The other thing that happened is my brother, I don't know if any of you know this, but I have a brother. He's actually my identical twin. He is also a writer. And he sent me a draft of his book, which is called Soon I Will Be Invincible. His name is Austin Grossman. You can add that to the list of books that are better than my book as well. It's incredibly good. And I was really freaking galled that he'd written this book that was so good. And I realized that I had to try to write something. And his book is actually a literary novel about superheroes. It's fantastic. But again, it proved to me that, in fact, I could use all this stuff that I'd been obsessively reading and then, you know, storing in the attic. And so I did. And I dragged up those files that I'd left in my hard drive, but of course they didn't really look as fresh and original as they had in 1996, because at that point we had 5 Harry Potter novels. This was 2004. It was in between, I'm going to get it wrong, I think it was in between Order of the Phoenix and Half-Blood Prince. We were in that gap. And when I looked at those files, I still, for some reason which I cannot explain at the present moment, I still wanted to write that novel, but obviously I couldn't write it the way that I had been about to write it. And the challenge that I had to solve, the problem that I had to solve, was to figure out how could I find my way into the fantasy tradition when the space that I had wanted to fit myself into was totally was totally filled up by J.K. Rowling. Ursula Le Guin had left like a little space where I could crawl into and sort of curl up, but there wasn't any space left, or it wasn't obvious where the space was. I wasn't going to be able to simply write my novel. I would have to write my novel, and it would have to be read by people who had read Harry Potter, and it had to stand up to that. And I began looking for ways that I could sort of claim or reclaim that story as my own. And what I did, essentially, was... I sort of grew Harry Potter up. I decided that I would write this story as if... And it was a story, still a story about the education of a wizard, but it was going to take place in the real world. It wasn't going to take place in the YA fantasy world. It was going to take place in the real world being the one that we live in, that has cell phones in it and the internet in it, that has sex in it, that has actual drinking in it, and it's not butter beer where you're not really sure if it's beer or not. It's just beer. It's just beer. And, you know, it raises questions. You know, what happens when if you're going to cast a spell when you're drunk? Would you bother to cast a spell at all if you were drunk? What happens when you have a school full of extremely sort of high-powered kids, teenagers, you know, who have hormones running rampant? What happens when you have this kind of hothouse environment and you give these kids all that power? What would they do? And I figured the answer would be they would do really terrible, irresponsible things to each other and themselves. Once I started finding my way into this, I just kept thinking of more and more ways that you could take the story and project it into the real world. One of the things I always noticed about Harry is that he's not much of a reader. He gets to Hogwarts, but he hasn't read. It's as if he hasn't read a fantasy novel in his life. Well, I just don't think that's very plausible. I mean, if he was growing up in that little closet in the Dursleys, I feel like he would spend the whole time, you know, reading Narnia novels and, you know, Fritz Lieber and Anne McCaffrey and Piers Anthony and T.H. White and all those books that I grew up reading. So the hero of the Magicians, when he gets to his school for magic, and he does get to a school for magic, but he perceives everything that happens to him through that lens, the lens of all the stuff that he's read, and he compares it to it, and everything that happens to him is just a little bit different from what books had led him to believe it was going to be like, including himself. He actually believes that he's going to be sort of the epic hero of some kind of high fantasy story, and of course he isn't. Which is very disappointing to him, because he sort of wanted to be. There's no Voldemort in The Magicians. There's no sort of big, overarching villain. And again, what does that do to the story? Well, in Harry Potter, you have Voldemort. You have this figure who personifies the ultimate evil. It sounds like I'm slagging off Harry Potter, which is ridiculous. I love Harry Potter. However, when you think about taking that story and putting it into our world, you don't really have Voldemort people in our world. And as a result, the world becomes very different. Voldemort kind of organizes Harry's world. For the most part, you know where everybody stands. You know who's evil, and you know who's good. You pretty much know who's a Death Eater and who isn't, except for Snape, who's kind of complicated. And you know what magic is for. Magic is for fighting evil. It's for fighting the villain. Well, if you take away the villain, you take away Voldemort, then you have a different kind of adventure. And the adventure is trying to figure out what the hell magic is for. If it's not for fighting evil, what do you do with it? And what would you do with magic and all that power that would be meaningful and make sense? And that's really the story of The Magicians. And I'm going to read you a short passage from The Magicians. It's relatively short, because I have a sort of massive phobia of authors who read endless excerpts from their work that take like hours and hours. I think this takes about... I would guess this takes about 8 or 9 minutes to read. It's from fairly near the beginning, and all you need to know is our hero is Quentin. He is a high school senior. He's very, very brilliant. So brilliant that through a kind of complicated mechanism that I'm not going to explain now, he's invited to take the entrance exam for a secret school for magic that's located in upstate New York. And... that's another thing. I figured if there's going to be a school for magic, you should probably have to take some kind of magic SAT to get in to see whether you have any aptitude. So that's what Quentin is doing, and it's this incredibly exhaustive exam. I don't know why I'm wrestling with the microphone. It's this incredibly exhaustive exam. It's taken all day and sort of tested every part of his mental faculties. And he's sort of been left alone. He's done the whole exam or almost all of the exam. He's been left alone in a room. He doesn't know whether he's passed or failed or if there's some extra part of the exam that hasn't happened yet, which actually turns out to be the case. And this guy, whose name is Dean Fogg, who's the head of the school, comes in to give him the rest of the exam. Let's see, is there anything else? I should tell you that Quentin, he's a big fantasy reader, and he's obsessed with these books that are about a magical land called Fillory. There's a reference in there that you'll hear. Fillory is just, it's a series of books that I made up, and it's a little bit like Narnia, and a little bit not. But that's what he's talking about when he talks about Fillory. All right, here we go. And this... some sort of PG-13 language in there. I don't think we have any minors present. All right. Cover your ears. With no warning, the door banged open and the dean walked in, talking over his shoulder at somebody behind him. A candidate? Fine, he said sarcastically. Let's see a candidate and bring some goddamned candles. He sat down at the table. His shirt was translucent with sweat. It was not impossible that he'd had a drink between now and the last time Quentin had seen him. Hello, Quentin. Please sit. He indicated the other chair, and Quentin sat. The dark-haired woman followed Fogg into the room, and after her came the old man with the knots, and the fat man with the lizard, and then the rest of the dozen or so men and women who had paraded through the room that afternoon. They formed lines along the walls and packed themselves into the corners, craning to look at him, whispering to one another. The punk kid with the tattoos was there, too. He slipped in just as the door was closing, unobserved by the faculty. Come on, come on. The dean waved them into the room. We should really do this in the conservatory next year. Pearl, you come around here. This to the young blonde woman who'd made Quentin draw a map. Now, he said, when they were all inside, Quentin, sit, please. Quentin was already sitting, so he scooched in his chair a little further. Dean Fogg took out of one pocket a fresh pack of cards, the plastic wrap still on them, and from the other he took a stack of nickels, maybe a dollar's worth, which he put down too emphatically so that they promptly slumped over. Quentin is an aficionado of stage magic. It's his hobby, and he does a lot of close-up magic, conjuring with cards and coins, and earlier in the day he had been showing off for the faculty. All right, let's get to it. Fogg clapped his hands and rubbed them together. Let's see some magic. He sat back in his chair and folded his arms. Well, hadn't they already done this part? Quentin kept his face studiously calm and unworried, but his mind was in free fall. Slowly, he unwrapped the stiff new cards, the plastic crackling deafeningly in the excruciating stillness, and he watched them from a mental mile away as his hands dutifully riffled and bridged them, and riffled and bridged. He searched his brain for a trick that he hadn't already done the first time around. Somebody coughed. He'd barely started his routine when Fogg stopped him. No, 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 no. Fogg chuckled, not especially kindly. Not like that. I want to see some real magic. He knocked twice on the hard tabletop with his knuckles and sat back again. Quentin took a deep breath and he searched Fogg's face for the good humor he'd seen there earlier, but Fogg just watched, expectantly. His eyes were a pale, milky blue, paler than eyes usually were. I don't really get what you mean, Quentin said slowly, in the silence, like he'd forgotten his line in the school play and had to ask for it. What do you mean, real magic? Well, I don't know. Fogg shot a hilarious sideways glance at the other teachers. I don't know what I mean. You tell me what I mean. Quentin shuffled a couple more times, stalling. He didn't know what to do. He would do anything if they would just tell him what he was supposed to do. This was it, he thought. He was coming to the end. This is what failure feels like. He looked around the room, but every face was either blank or avoiding his gaze. No one was going to help him. He was going back to Brooklyn. Maddeningly, he could feel tears pooling in his eyes. He blinked them away. He so badly wanted not to care, but he was falling backward and sinking down inside himself. And there was nothing there, nothing there to catch him. This is it, he thought. This was the test that he couldn't pass. It wasn't really all that surprising. He was just wondering how long they were going to let it go on. "Stop fucking with us, Quentin," Fogg barked. He snapped his fingers. "Come on. Wake up." He reached across the table and he grabbed Quentin's hands roughly. The contact was a shock. His fingers were strong and strangely dry and hot. He was moving Quentin's fingers, physically forcing them into positions that they didn't want to be in. "Like this," he was saying. "Like this. Like this." "Okay, stop," Quentin said. He tried to pull away. "Stop." But Fogg didn't stop. The audience shifted uncomfortably, and somebody said something. Fogg kept on working Quentin's hands with both of his, kneading them. He bent Quentin's fingers back, stretching them apart so that the webs between his fingers burned. Light seemed to flash between their hands. "I said stop it!" Quentin jerked his hands away. It was surprising how good the anger felt. It was something to grab onto. In the shocked silence that followed, he took a deep breath, and he forced it out through his nose. When it was out, he felt like he'd expelled some of his despair with it. He'd had enough of being judged. He'd been sucking it up his whole life, but even he had his limit. Fogg was talking again, but now Quentin wasn't even listening. He'd begun to recite something under his breath, something familiar. It took him a second to realize that the words he was mouthing weren't English. They were from the foreign language that he'd invented earlier that afternoon. It was an obscure language, he'd decided, indigenous to a single tropical archipelago. Alangra's hot weather paradise, a Gauguin painting, blessed with black sand beaches and breadfruit trees and freshwater springs, and endowed with an angry, glowing red volcano god and an oral culture rich in obscene expletives. Quentin spoke this language fluently, with no accent, like a native. The words he spoke were not a prayer exactly, they were more of an incantation. Quentin stopped shuffling the cards. There was no going back. Everything snapped into very slow, slow motion, as if the room had filled up with a viscous but perfectly clear liquid, in which everyone and everything floated easily and calmly. Everyone and everything except for Quentin, who moved quickly. With two hands together, as if he were releasing a dove, he tossed the deck of cards lightly up to the ceiling. The deck broke apart and scattered in flight, like a meteorite, losing cohesion in the atmosphere. And as the cards fluttered down to earth, they stacked themselves on the tabletop. They formed a house of cards. It was a recognizable model of the building that they were sitting in. The cards fell as if by chance, but each one perfectly, snapping into place magnetically, edge to edge, one after the other. The last two, the aces of spades and hearts, leaned up against each other to make the roof over the clock tower. Now the room was absolutely still. Dean Fogg sat as if he were frozen in place. All the hairs were standing up on Quentin's arms, but he knew what he was doing. His fingers left almost imperceptible phosphorescent trails behind them in the air. He definitely felt high. He leaned forward and blew lightly on the card house, and it collapsed back down into a neatly stacked deck. He turned the deck over and fanned it out on the table like a blackjack dealer. Every card was a queen. All the standard suits, plus other suits that didn't exist, in different colors, green and yellow and blue, the queen of horns, the queen of clocks, the queen of bees, the queen of books. Some were clothed, and some were shamelessly naked. Some of them had Julia's face. Some of them had the lovely paramedics. Dean Fogg watched Quentin intently. Everybody watched him. Watch this. Quentin squared the deck again, and with no particular effort, he ripped it in half, and then he ripped the halves in half, and he tossed the resulting confetti at the assembled company, who all flinched, except for Fogg. Quentin stood up, and his chair fell over backward. Tell me where I am, Quentin said softly. Tell me what I'm doing here. He picked up the stack of nickels in his fist, only it was no longer a stack of coins. It was the hilt of a bright, burning sword that he drew easily out of the tabletop as if it had been left there, buried up to the hilt. Tell me what's going on here, Quentin said, louder, to the room, and if this place isn't fillery, then for fuck's sake, will somebody please tell me where the hell I am? Quentin let the tip of the sword hover under Fogg's nose for a slow 10 count, and then he reversed his grip and stabbed it down into the wood of the table. The point bit deep into the buttery wood and stuck there. Fogg didn't move, and the sword waggled in place. Quentin sniffed involuntarily, and the last of the light from the window died. It was night. Well, now, the dean said, finally. He removed a neatly folded handkerchief from his pocket and patted his forehead. I think we can all agree that that was a pass. Thank you. A horrible thing happened. I noticed as I read that there's a typo in the book. My perfect book has a little typo in it. I guess that's a moment that happens to every author. I feel like I've probably exceeded my allotted time. So I will now stand down from the podium, but I'm going to wander around a little bit, and I can certainly sign copies if anybody wants a signed copy. Thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.